This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The progressive-minded activists among us aspire to bring our lifestyles in line with our values. One place where this commonly happens is in our diets. Now, it's been thought that having a vegetarian or vegan diet is a surefire way to lessen one's impact on the planet while making a demand for cruelty-free food. But it's not that simple. It's never that simple. One young woman found out through her own journey in search for ethical eating that a vegetarian diet brought its own set of challenges to her values and her health. In a creative exploration of that journey, Marissa Landrigan has written a coming-of-age story called The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food. Marissa Landrigan is currently an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh, Johnstown, where she teaches creative and digital writing. Her essays have appeared in numerous publications, including The Atlantic, Salon, and Guernica, and she runs the food-themed reading series called Acquired Taste. She now joins me to discuss her book. Welcome to the program, Marissa.
Hi, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
So you started out as a young woman before you went to college in an Italian-American household, eating meat and having a family life that centered partly on food. And then you watched a documentary in college by PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And that kind of was a starting point in your changing your mind about what you should be eating and why. Tell us a little bit about that story, that first transition point in your youth.
Well, like many Americans, I grew up in the suburbs, which meant that before I saw that video when I was in college, I had really never seen an actual working farm before. I didn't have a clear sense for where my food came from and what it looked like to actually raise that food. And so when I was in college, I watched this investigative undercover video from PETA, and I saw for the first time what a factory farm was, saw the conditions in which the animals were raised, the ways in which they were treated, and of course, the process by which they were slaughtered for food production. And I found it really just horrifying, some very gruesome imagery in there, as anyone who's seen those kinds of videos knows. And it was really the first time that I got a clear sense for what it actually took to process animals for me to eat. And I just couldn't abide it. I found that I didn't want to participate in such a system. And so I thought it best to just boycott it completely by cutting meat out from my diet.
Right. So cutting meat out would, first of all, ensure that you wouldn't be part of a very cruel practice that inflicts, you know, really horrific cruelty on animals, not just in how they're killed, but even just how they are raised. But also, were you concerned about, at that time, reducing your footprint on your planet? You hear a lot of people saying, you know, if everyone just became vegetarian or vegan, we would reduce greenhouse gases dramatically and have a much more sustainable lifestyle. And so it's sort of tempting to think that one magic, that can be a magic bullet.
Absolutely. It was shortly after I became a vegetarian that a friend actually recommended to me Francis Morlappe's Diet for a Small Planet, and I discovered the ways in which a vegetarian diet was also more sort of environmentally friendly, environmentally sustainable. And it really became an additional sort of feather in the cap of the reason why I wanted to stay vegetarian, as I certainly wanted to have as small a carbon footprint as possible.
I was in your place. As a young woman at age 16, I became vegetarian, and my friends now tell me that back then, those who knew me back then, I had a whiff of moral superiority when I sat down at the table to eat with them. Did you feel that same way? Did you have that same sense looking back on your younger self?
I think I did, especially when it came time to return home and eat among my family, because for so long, food had been so significant to my family, it had been a real place of coming together, and I had now taken this step that set me apart from the rest of my family, and my mother still very much wanted to sort of keep me in the fold. She was great about cooking vegetarian options for me, but as I really did sort of set myself apart from the rest of them and thought I was more well-informed, I was was making better choices than they were, and I really sort of took it up as a political badge of honor.
But it wasn't easy to transition to a meatless diet, right? I mean, you were used to eating meat. Did you miss it?
I did miss it, and I especially missed it when it came time to actually figuring out what I should be eating. For the most part, I had never really considered how much of my meals were really built around meat before then. I was eating a very stereotypical American diet where I had meat and starch and vegetable, and I didn't really know what to do with that extra space on the plate once I subtracted the meat. And so unfortunately, I sort of filled it in with more starches, more carbohydrates, certainly more processed foods, and a lot of fake meat substitute products, rather than actually reframing my diet around primarily produce.
Let's talk about the fake meat substitutes. I heavily relied on them too in my quest to balance a diet, and it's, you know, they're a big business too. You know, you hear about, you can today get fake bacon, fake burgers, you can buy soy rizos, you know, soy chorizo. Most of them are soy-based, grain-based. What's wrong with these products? Why isn't, even if they are processed, don't they still have a smaller carbon footprint? Might they not be better for you even health-wise? What's wrong with them?
Well, part of the reason that I think these products can be problematic is that they sort of become a crutch, right? And they allow us to sort of continue not eating meat without really changing our dietary approach. And so while it's true in some cases that they can have a better health impact, a lesser environmental impact, if too many people rely on them too heavily, that lessened impact actually goes away. There is, for example, some data to suggest that the increased demand for tofu worldwide and these other soy-based products has actually very significantly increased the number of acres that are devoted to growing soybean crops. And in some of those cases, clearing rainforest in South America, for example, to grow a soybean crop there. So as more and more people switch to a vegetarian diet, that demand, of course, increases.
And what about the companies what about the companies themselves that produce these products? Are they, you know, small family-owned companies, or are they also part of our industrial big food system?
This is truly the other big problem, is that at this point, as you said, it's good business to make these kinds of products. More and more people are becoming vegan or vegetarian and relying on them. And so big business is getting in on the game as well. So while many organic and fake meat substitute brands started as small family businesses, many of them are now owned by large multinational food conglomerates. For instance, both the Morningstar and Garden Burger brands, which make veggie burgers and other substitute products, are owned now by the Kraft Heinz Corporation, which is now one large corporation. Kraft Heinz also owns brands like Oscar Mayer, for instance. So if you're buying a Garden Burger, your food dollars are going to the same company that makes the Oscar Mayer wieners.
And the definition of vegetarian is incredibly broad. I mean, basically, it's minus meat. So in college, my vegetarian option at my dorm cafe was French fries with ranch dressing. What was yours?
Well, I was very lucky, actually, to go to a very progressive college that actually had a separate vegan station.
Ooh,
but
fancy.
For the most part, that vegan station usually served black bean burgers and sweet potato fries.
Right. My University of Texas food choices were basically French fries. But even besides that, I mean, you can eat macaroni and cheese and ramen noodles. You can eat cereal with milk. You can survive on simply bread and call yourself a vegetarian. Is that good for the health of the planet and your own personal health in the long run?
It's certainly not good for your own personal health, as I discovered firsthand. My first few years as a vegetarian, I was eating almost exclusively those kinds of processed, prepackaged foods, macaroni and cheese, ramen noodles. I became quite a fan of the cheese sandwich at my college dining hall, just making sandwiches without meat in them. And so again, the problem really became that I wasn't actually reframing my diet by putting primarily produce and nuts and other healthy options first in line. And so in that way, I also wasn't really making a dietary choice that was better for the planet, because I was eating products that had been made with the same kinds of corn and soy and grain crops that were going to feed the livestock animals that I was avoiding eating.
Now, in your quest for ethical eating, you left the East Coast and you went to Montana. Very different food culture in Montana. What did you find when you got to Montana that sort of further made you question how you had made your own eating choices?
Well, when I moved to Montana, I moved right into the heart of a frontier hunting culture, a place really where hunting is a very significant part of a lot of people's food consumption. And people take very seriously the notion of killing and processing their own meat products. And that was a really difficult thing for me, because I had essentially boycotted meat because I couldn't stomach the look of processing animals for food. And so all of a sudden, there I was right in the middle of it. People had, you know, deer and elk carcasses in the back of their pickup trucks or hanging in their backyards as they were processing these animals. And that was something that I had sort of chosen to try to avoid looking at. And that certainly wasn't possible in Montana. But what I found there were a lot of people who really cared very deeply about where their food came from and how it was processed, and in fact had made the choice to do it themselves because they wanted to sort of look more closely at it. And that was really in conflict with what I had understood the livestock production industry to be about.
Right. And so, you know, people, even, for example, in indigenous cultures, often incorporate meat into their diet, but it's meat that they're usually much more personally intimate with in terms of the capture and killing and preparation of that food. You also traveled to Ghana, where you sort of firsthand found that your choice to simply cut meat out of your diet seem to be born more out of privilege than ethics. Tell us about that experience.
Absolutely. I discovered in Ghana, really, that it was an enormous privilege to be able to make the choice to cut meat out of my diet and still remain healthy and still have a lot of options when it came to what I could eat and how I could really balance my diet without meat in it. And what I saw in Ghana was that not everyone has the privilege to make those kinds of dietary choices.
Right, they couldn't just go to the supermarket and buy a Boca burger.
Exactly. And they couldn't even go to the supermarket and buy, say, a lot of leafy greens, something that many vegans or vegetarians use to substitute for protein, because leafy greens simply don't grow in that climate as well as staple and starch-based crops like tubers and potatoes and things like that did. The family that I stayed with in Ghana was a very privileged family, and they only ate meat about once a week. But for them, that animal protein was really crucial to their health. The family that I stayed with, their son had been hospitalized the year before I was there for malaria, and his mother attributed his recovery from that disease to the fact that she had been able to procure and acquire for him some animal protein, which was relatively rare in the town, but really sort of boosted his immune system enough that he could fight off the infection.
How did they view your vegetarianism?
They were very kind, very supportive, truly. Luckily, my mother had a close relationship with the family that I was staying with, and so they really did accommodate it. But they were very worried about my health. In fact, one morning, they brought out a can of garbanzo beans, chickpeas, for me to eat with my breakfast, which was made of eggs, condensed eggs, of course, because Ajwa, the mother, the matriarch of the family, said she was worried that I wasn't getting enough protein. And so it was really important to them to make sure that I balanced out the absence of meat with other sources of protein, because that was really the way that they saw meat in their diet.
Marissa, a lot of our audience who might be vegetarian or vegan are probably saying to themselves right now, well, you don't need to have meat in your diet in order to get complete proteins. This is a point, a contentious point. It's a well-debated point. Where do you stand on this issue of if you want a balanced diet, you do need protein, and animal protein is an efficient way to get it, and on the other side says, no, it's not. It might be efficient in that you can go and buy it from the supermarket, but it's carbon footprint is highly inefficient. You can get the same proteins from rice and beans.
I actually do think that you can get enough protein in your diet without animal protein, at least here in the United States and in other developed countries. But I think that isn't true everywhere. And I also think it's important to note that it's not necessarily true even everywhere within the United States. There are a lot of communities where finding those other sources of healthy proteins can be quite difficult if you don't have access to, say, a full grocery store within traveling distance of your neighborhood. And so I think it's important to realize the privilege that's involved in finding those other substitutes for animal protein and to remember that not everyone has access to those substitutes.
How much of your journey to ethical eating was hampered by your inexperience with food preparation and sort of really putting emphasis on careful food preparation? I mean, it's definitely a struggle for all of us who worry about where our food comes from and how to bring our own lifestyles in line with our values. So tell us a little bit about that aspect of your story.
Sure. It's true that to cook and eat ethically and healthily and sustainably usually requires cooking most of your food yourself. And what I was doing for most of my years as a vegetarian was outsourcing a lot of that food preparation to industrial agriculture by buying these processed and prepackaged foods. I wasn't devoting nearly enough time to cooking from fresh, healthy, whole ingredients. And that, of course, is really the key to eating ethically and sustainably. And so I think that once I sort of started going back to eating meat, I really committed to cooking, finding a way to become a better cook. And I think that's such a crucial part of helping people reframe their diets to be more ethical and sustainable.
How did that clash with your feminist values that didn't want to see yourself as a woman in the kitchen cooking?
Yes, unfortunately, I had this very narrow view of what it would be like to be a woman in the kitchen and a feminist. From a very young age, I knew I wanted to be a career woman. I wanted to be an independent woman. And unfortunately, I sort of began to conflate that with not cooking or not really participating in any of these sort of domestic activities. I grew up in a house where my mother did all of the cooking, with the exception of an occasional, hamburger on the backyard grill. My mother, of course, also did work full-time and have a career as well. So I certainly had a role model for someone who is capable of doing both of those things. But I, at some point, sort of shied away from the kitchen as a domestic space. I didn't want to sort of get sucked into taking on the responsibility of cooking for a family. I think that I had a sense of what a significant responsibility that really was. And I worried that if I allowed myself to sort of go down that path, I would abandon some of my career dreams. As I said, unfortunately, that's a really narrow view of both feminism and cooking, one that luckily I have been able to reframe as I have gone back actually to eating meat and become more of a cook.
So let's talk about that. You finally began to eat meat, and in the book, you chronicle that path to buying your first chicken and preparing it. What led you back to meat? And and under what circumstances do you continue to be a meat consumer?
Sure. Well, what really led me back to eating meat was something that you said at the beginning of the program, Sonali, which was realizing that this wasn't so simple. This wasn't a black and white decision where being a vegetarian was always going to be more ethical and sustainable than being a meat eater. And what led me to that discovery was really the time that I spent living in Iowa. Iowa is one of the centers, of course, of American industrial agriculture. Corn and soy monoculture for miles around the town where I lived, and there were even Tyson and Smithfield processing plants very nearby. But I also discovered in Iowa a network of small farmers who had owned their farms, whose farms had been in their family for many, many years, for centuries in some cases, who really took pride in ownership of the land, who treated it very, very respectfully, who really committed to sustainable farming practices, who also raised livestock animals. And for many of them, livestock animals were an integral part of their biodynamic farm system. And so when I saw this, these models of small-scale sustainable farms, I thought, well, this is the kind of farming that I do want to support. It stands in stark contrast to that industrial model of agriculture that I saw way back on the PETA video. And yet, they are also raising and processing animals. And it no longer made sense to me to boycott all meat production when some of that meat production looked like this, was, like I said, local, family-owned, and really sustainable in nature. And so I decided it made more sense to support the systems that looked like the kind of sustainable farm that I'd always imagined supporting when I became a vegetarian, than it made sense to just continue to blanket boycott all meat production.
And on the issue of animal cruelty, which is, of course, PETA's main issue, and they've managed to change a lot of minds with those sorts of videos, what did you also discover about the fact that not enough people were talking about the conditions that humans faced in farming? You also, in your journey, went to California, where you found the conditions that undocumented farm workers faced in picking the fruits and vegetables that vegans and vegetarians rely on. And of course,
That's
all of us
right.
rely on. Everybody relies on.
I discovered, yeah, absolutely, and unfortunately discovered that it wasn't even new information, that it was just something that I had myself never really paid attention to, that farming is one of the most dangerous and toxic jobs in the United States, that farm workers have higher rates of birth defects and cancer than almost any other industry, and that's largely because these farm workers are exposed, of course, to toxic chemicals in the form of pesticides and herbicides. But it's also because that in many cases, farms are exempt from fair labor standards, such as minimum wages and the age of minimum labor laws. And this means, of course, that farm workers are not generally working in a safe or healthy environment. And as you said, most of the farm workers in this country are undocumented migrant workers who, because they have no legal rights, have no real recourse for the unsafe conditions in which they're working. And I was really horrified to discover that I had spent so many years thinking about animal cruelty and almost no time at all thinking about the conditions in which the humans who produced the food that I was eating as a vegetarian also worked. Mm-hmm.
Then there's also the issue of the cost of eating healthy and ethically. If all of us were to want to navigate our food systems to minimize impact on human rights, minimize impact on the climate, we also have to shell out a lot of money. I mean, you know, a chicken that you buy at the supermarket that's raised in a factory farm could cost you $5. You go to a family farm, that same chicken could cost you $20. How do low-income Americans, does it also in the end become an act of privilege to incorporate meat or vegetables in your diet if you're looking only for those ethically sourced foods?
It absolutely is an act of privilege. In the way that our current food system is set up in modern America, even just healthy food is more expensive. A recent study from the Harvard School for Public Health found that eating a diet that was primarily focused on healthy foods like produce, nuts, and fish actually costs more than eating a diet made up primarily of red meat and processed foods. So that's even just eating actually a healthy and well-balanced diet costs more. And in addition to it costing more, it's more difficult to access those foods, especially in low-income neighborhoods where there may not be a large-scale grocery store, but only a convenience store, a bodega, or a gas station that sells food within at least comfortable walking distance. And so I think it's really important for those of us who want to eat ethically and sustainably to be really aware of the privilege of the choices that we make when it comes to which farms we support and which systems we support. I think it's really important for those of us who are able to support the small scale, the local, and the family farms, because as we do that, of course, as our demand increases, they're able to keep costs down and hopefully able to take advantage of programs that allow them to make their food accessible to low-income neighborhoods and communities. And hopefully we also are working to reform the food system on a national scale to help improve access to healthy and sustainable and ethical food for all communities.
Right. I mean, these large companies that produce, you know, whether they're producing chickens and corn and soy fed beef, or they're creating Boca burgers, they are receiving often huge subsidies because they're large scale farms. Their processes are heavily reliant on fossil fuel consumption and production of fossil fuels. None of those costs get passed down to the consumer at the point of sale, but they do, of course, impact all of us in terms of climate, in terms of our tax dollars and subsidies. How important is balancing our diets with political action to change the food system?
I think that both are really important. I think that spending our food dollars wisely is crucial, being really aware of where our food money is going and what systems we're supporting is really crucial. But I think we also need political action, because I truly do think that there is only so far that we can go as individuals spending our food dollars. We can also spend time, of course, volunteering in our communities and supporting local change that might help improve access to low-income neighborhoods and communities. For instance, helping to make sure our local farmers markets are providing access for people who use SNAP or WIC benefits to purchase healthy produce, which is now supported through both the SNAP and WIC programs. But oftentimes, local farmers and local markets don't have the resources to help make that transition. So I think we can also work in our local communities, and we can also advocate for large-scale change on the national level by, for example, supporting a shift in the way that the federal government subsidizes sizes of farms and certain kinds of farms.
So it's not just about what's on your plate, but what you do yourself as an activist if you care about food systems. Marissa, thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
My guest is Marissa Landrigan, assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh, Johnstown, where she teaches creative, professional, and digital writing. Her essays have appeared in numerous publications, including The Atlantic, Salon, and Guernica, and she runs the food-themed reading series called Acquired Taste. We've been discussing her book, The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.